Well, we are in a lengthy series through the Gospel of Luke, and if you have a Bible, if you brought a copy of the Scriptures with you, I invite you to turn to Luke chapter 20. We have several small little passages or little encounters that we're going to group together this morning, and if you are much of a reader of fiction, or if you're a movie watcher, you know that there are a handful of stories that keep getting told over and over and over again. There is the kind of romantic story of love gained, love lost, love regained. And if you were to, you know, look at all of the romantic comedies or all of the romance, you know, movies or whatever, it'd be interesting to see how many follow that same scenario. Love gained, love lost, love regained. Or there's also the theme or the story, kind of the David and Goliath, where you have maybe a sports team that is kind of down and out or something like that, and for one reason or another, they gel as a group, and then they, you know, battle against the state champions, or they battle against whatever, and it's the same story, you know, whether it's called, you know, Remember the Titans, or Hoosiers, or, you know, it's like the same story being told over and over again, and we love that story. There's also this kind of redemption story, where you start off the story, and you've got evil in power. And you've got people who are oppressed, or an individual who's oppressed, and it looks like as the story goes on, or the movie goes on, it just gets darker and darker, and it looks like evil's going to win. And you just hope that something's going to happen, or maybe someone is going to enter into the picture and is going to make everything right, and is going to expose evil for what it is, and is going to exalt that one who is humble, or that one who is righteous, and those types of things, that someone, that a new sheriff is going to come into town, or the king is going to come in, or the knight is going to come in, and is going to make everything right. One of the classics of that storyline is Cinderella, where you've got the evil stepsisters and the evil stepmother, and it looks like they're going to win. It looks like they have got Cinderella completely cornered, but you hope that when the prince comes, that somehow Cinderella can make it to the ball, you know, when the son of the king comes, who has the authority of the king, that somehow this prince is going to make it right. And all the way up till the end, it looks like the stepsisters are going to win. Until the prince finally does come, and Cinderella has a way to get to the ball, and then what the prince does is he's not fooled by the evil of the stepsisters. He actually exposes their evil, and then he exalts the one who is true and noble and humble and those types of things. And we love that story. That is similar to the story we're going to look at this morning. And we're going to see that played out as we go along, and we'll revisit that theme here as we go. We have, a couple of weeks ago, we started in the Holy Week, the triumphal entry of Jesus Christ in Luke 19, where Jesus rides in with authority. He rides in with an entourage of people who are laying down their coats. He rides in with songs of praise. He rides in on a symbol. But his symbol is not a white stallion or an ornate chariot. His symbol is a prophetic symbol of the colt, the foal of a donkey, representing his humility and those types of things. But he does ride in as a king. And he is praised for that. And then he goes into the temple, and his authority is questioned. And he is challenged. And then he gives a parable, and we talked about how important that parable is, the parable of the vine grower, where he places himself within the whole flow of biblical history, and he reveals how important he really is, that he is the beloved son in this story. He is the final word of the vineyard owner who sends his son to the workers of the vineyard, pleading with them to change. And he is rejected. And judgment is going to fall. And
and we get to verse 19 of chapter 20, and it's a great transition to the passage we're going to look at, the rest of the chapter we're going to look at today. Verse 19 says, "The scribes and the chief priests tried to lay hands on him that very hour, and they feared the people, for they understood that he spoke this parable against them." They've been exposed. And now what we're going to see is them pulling themselves into the background a little bit, sending others into this battle because they've now been exposed. So we have seen Jesus come in with authority demonstrated, and you know, as he rides in, we see his authority questioned in the temple. We're now going to see his authority as the king asserted. And we're going to see it in an interesting way. He's going to come in and he's going to talk about his authority. He's going to make authoritative statements in matters of earth, matters of heaven, matters of evil and righteousness, and he's going to polarize evil and righteousness, and he's going to speak as one with ultimate authority in every area. Let's jump in verse 20. "So they watched him and sent spies who pretended to be righteous in order that they might catch him in some statement so that they could deliver him to the rule and authority of the governor. They questioned him, saying, 'Teacher, we know that you speak and teach correctly, and you are not partial to any, but teach the way of God in truth. Is it lawful for us to pay taxes to Caesar or not?' But he detected their trickery and said to them, 'Show me a denarius. Whose likeness and inscription does it have?' They said, 'Caesar's.' And he said to them, 'Then render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's.' And they were unable to catch him in a saying in the presence of the people, and being amazed at his answer, they became silent." They come to Jesus with the same type of, you know, either or question that Jesus presented to the leaders just in a previous passage when he asked about the authority that John had. Was it from God or is it from man? And they found themselves trapped in an either or type thing. If there was no right answer for them to give, that they would be protected. And so they come to him with an either or type question, thinking that this is the perfect question, that they've got him this time. Because this whole thing of paying taxes to Rome is a really tricky issue for the Jews at this time. There was, you know, at this time, a group within Jewish leadership called the Nationalists. They also had the Zealots, who were much more zealous nationalists. But they both believed that when Messiah comes, that the main thing that Messiah was going to do is throw off Roman authority. And they felt, and the Zealots later took up arms against Rome, that it was just morally and ethically wrong for God's people to pay tribute to an evil pagan authority over them. And so they ask a question, is it lawful, teacher? You know, they kind of butter him up there in verse 21. We know that you're, you know, impartial. We know that you speak true. They're trying to get him to speak boldly about something, to give an answer one way or another. And Jesus is going to be trapped whichever answer he gives. Because if he says no, or if he says, yes, it is lawful to pay taxes, you know, those types of things, then he's going to alienate the nationalists. And all of those who hoped that Messiah, that when he rode into Jerusalem, what he was going to do is to throw off the Romans. And so there was all these people who sang his praise and think that he is the guy, and they're going to try to alienate all of those people from Jesus by having him say, pay taxes to Rome. But if he says, no, don't pay taxes to Rome, then all they have to do is hand him over to the governing authorities, and he'll be executed for sedition, for rebellion. And so either way, he either loses his popularity or he loses his life. And they can do it, and the leaders can do it in such a way where they don't have to get their hands dirty. They send someone else in to ask the question. And which is it going to be? Are you going to lose your popularity or are you going to lose your life? Jesus gives them, an answer. Obviously, you're familiar. Many of you, if you've read the Gospels before, you're familiar with this answer that he gives. And he asks them to pull out a denarius and ask them what inscription is on there. And it's important that he says, show me a denarius. He doesn't pull one out of his own pocket. He has them pull one out of theirs. Because they are carrying in their pocket every day a symbol of Roman sovereignty over the financial system. This is money that they hold. This is money that they use, they accept, they spend, they value. They, you know, the state that they were living under produced a financial system that they were in agreement with. And that they, you know, were subject under, and that they were using this money. And so that he has them say, you know, there's no use in arguing here. Pull out a coin that you use, that you hold, that you value. Whose inscription's on it? Well, Caesar's is. And he says, render unto Caesar then. You're already recognizing Roman sovereignty in the financial system. Render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's. But render unto God that which is God's. You know, this question that Jesus speaks, you know, this is an issue even today in different corners and in different debates and those types of things. How is it possible to be a good Christian and a good citizen at the same time? How do you pledge your allegiance to a higher kingdom and yet live under the authority of a governing system that you don't agree with all the time? And how does it work? And is this governing system that's over us, the government that we live under, when they do things that are wrong or they do things that are evil that we don't agree with, are we obligated to continue to give them money and taxes? And how does that relationship work? And Jesus gives the answer. And he says that honoring God does not negate the state's right to exist and to function and to raise tribute from its citizens in order to exist. Jesus recognizes the divinely appointed institution of government and the sovereignty that God has over it. And Paul and Peter both teach the same thing and in different ways. Listen to what Paul says in Romans 13. Every person, well, let me just back up. Paul is also speaking living under Roman rule. And if you think of a wicked and evil government, you're going to have to picture, you know, list Rome as part of that list. Every person is to be in subjection to governing authorities. For this, there is no authority except from God. And those which exist are established by God. Therefore, whoever resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God. And they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. For rulers are not a cause of fear for good behavior, but for evil. Do you want to have no fear of authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. For it is a minister of God to you for good. But if you do what is evil, be afraid, for it does not bear the sword for nothing. For it is a minister of God, an avenger, to bring wrath on those who practice evil. Therefore, it is necessary to be in subjection, not only because of wrath, but also for conscience' sake. For because of this, you also pay taxes. For rulers are servants of God, devoting themselves to this very thing. Render to all what is due them. Tax to whom tax is due. Custom to whom custom is due. Fear to whom fear is due. Honor to whom honor is due. So Paul says essentially what Jesus is saying is that Jesus is saying this governing authority that is over us, you're already recognizing their sovereignty by carrying their coins. It's not like they went off into the wilderness and got rid of all their money and now going back to bartering to one another. They're recognizing the authority of this governing system to exist. And they're using their money. And he says, then your role then is to be a good citizen
and to be subject under it, and render to Caesar that which is Caesar's. And what Paul and what Peter would say, and you know, Peter would say even more explicitly, that you are to be such good citizens, you are to live in such a way that anything that is slandered against you because you, you know, serve one God and one God only, that they would be ashamed for that slander because of your excellent behavior, because you do things so excellently in the way that you live your life.
So render to Caesar that which is Caesar's, and, Jesus says, render to God that which is God's.
And I think there's an interesting play here, because you have an image on a coin of Caesar. In Genesis, it says, we walk around every day with the image of God in our body. We are created in the image of God. So he says, render to Caesar that which is Caesar, these coins, but render to God your body, because that belongs to him. Because you carry his image on you. And the problem for most of us is not that we're failing. You know, I don't doubt many of us, hopefully none of us, are cheating in our taxes and those types of things, not rendering to Caesar that which is Caesar. The problem for most of us is not that we're failing to render to Caesar. The problem is that we're not rendering to God that which is his. And that is our very being. Our physical body, our soul, and who we are. So, Jesus is asked a very earthly question. What is the relationship here between God's people and the state? Are we to pay taxes and tribute to Rome or not? And without blinking, he speaks as one with authority on these issues, on the issues of earth, and the issues that we deal with, you know, very, very practical, very pragmatic, very earthly things. He speaks with authority on such things. Then we go to the next question. Verse 27. Now there came to him some Sadducees, who say there is no resurrection. And they questioned him, saying, Teacher, Moses wrote for us that if a man's brother dies, having a wife, and he is childless, his brother should marry the wife and raise up children to his brother. Now there were seven brothers, and the first took a wife and died childless. And the second and the third married her, and in the same way, all seven died, having no children. Let me just stop here. This is what you call a bad luck woman. Can you imagine being the fifth guy in line, you know, after seeing your brothers, you know, die off? And it's like, wow. Do I really have to do this? Right. Finally, the woman died also. In the resurrection, therefore, which one's wife will she be? For all seven had married her. This is referring to, and we've talked about this before, this is referring to a practice called levirate marriage. And it's a practice that's kind of lumped in or very similar to the practice of the kinsman redeemer as well. To where in the kinsman redeemer, you'd have if somebody, you know, if you lose your property or if even you have to sell yourself into slavery because you're so far in debt, that a kinsman would come and purchase your freedom or purchase your property back and let you continue to live on it to keep that property in the family. Because from the Joshua conquest on, you know, property was supposed to stay in the family. Well, very similar to that, practice called levirate marriage, to where if a woman married a man, or if a couple gets married, the man dies having no children, then his line is going to die with him. And so to protect that, to keep his line, to keep his to keep the family name going, or to keep that family line going, his brother would marry this woman. For one reason was to protect and provide financial security for this woman, because widows in that time were very vulnerable and they couldn't take care of them. They had a lot of difficulty taking care of themselves. And so to protect this woman, there was a practice that the brother would come and marry this woman and provide for her, provide financially for her. But they would also, if God blessed with a child in the second marriage, that first child would be raised under the name of the deceased man. This happens in Ruth, if you're familiar with that story. So that this child, even though the child is not the biological, you know, child of the first husband, he is regarded as the child of the first husband, so that that name would continue. So that's the practice that's going on here, and it is a biblical practice for this time. But the question is not really about that, is it? I mean, this is kind of like, this question is within the category of questions like, well, what about all those people in Africa that have never heard? Or what about them? What about them? Or what about, you know, people who, you know, mentally can't understand the gospel and they're retarded? Hey, what about them? Or what about, you know, what about babies who die? Or what about, you know, did Adam and Eve have a belly button? You know, it's like those types of questions, where you're just sort of bringing up a topic, but it's not really about that topic. It's about your distrust of scriptures, or, you know, those types of things. And so Jesus answers their question. He's going to get to this in verse 34, but then he's going to continue on and answer the real issue as we get into verse 37. Well, his answer, verse 34, the sons of this age, Jesus said to them, the sons of this age are given in marriage, but those who are considered worthy to attain to that age and the resurrection from the dead neither marry nor are given in marriage, for they cannot die anymore, because they are like angels and are the sons of God, being sons of the resurrection. And then I'm going to stop there, because he's going to go on there in verse 37. And his answer to them is that a couple things that we sort of notice, and I think it's in verse 35. Yeah. One thing is that not everybody's going to attain to the resurrection. That should be the first thing that jumps off the page. That this, you know, not everybody is going to be resurrected unto life and glory in the presence of God. You know, that's not really Jesus' main point, but he certainly brings that out here. The second thing is that in the resurrection, it's different than it is right now. Things are different. Relationships are different. We don't know exactly what the resurrection is going to be like. We know that we will have bodies like the resurrected Christ, but that's about all we know. But Jesus says there's going to be no death, and we are going to be in that way like angels who don't marry, they don't reproduce, they don't die, they don't need food. And, you know, and when Jesus says that in that way we're going to be like angels, this is not agreeing with, you know, that sort of sappy sentimentality that says, you know, go to heaven and eventually get your wings. You know, if you've ever seen that in movies or whatever, it's like humans don't evolve into angels. You know, humans are humans, angels are angels. 1 Corinthians 6 talks about we will one day judge the angels because they are the servants and we are the sons. You know, there's a difference. But in this way, we will be like angels. And so marriage, there is no such thing as marriage in the resurrection, because there's no such thing as the need for marriage in the resurrection. There's no bringing up of children. There's no need for an institution which pictures something else, like marriage pictures what the relationship with Christ is supposed to be like. In the resurrection, that relationship with Christ is there. You know, for some of you, it may seem kind of hurtful or maybe a little sad or something like that to think that you're not going to be married anymore in the resurrection. Others of you, forever's a long time, you know. Until death do us part, you know, and that there's no marriage in heaven or no marriage in the resurrection because there's no excess baggage to my wife. The relationship with my wife right now is supposed to be a dim picture of what a relationship with Christ is supposed to be, because someday my wife will no longer be the bride of Greg Holmes. She will be the bride of Christ, and the relationship with Christ will be perfect. And she will also, she'll have a relationship with the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. She will know as she is known, and she will also have complete and open fellowship with all her brothers and sisters in Christ, and I would just be excess baggage to her then. Now, hopefully, we can still meet and have coffee, you know? But the reason that marriage is supposed to be something that pictures a future hope, once you're in that future hope, there's no more need for marriage. And I don't understand it. I don't understand what the resurrection is going to be like. I'm assuming that when I'm there, I will understand it. He kind of points out the error in their thinking when they just assume that the life to come is just like this life. And it isn't. There's differences. But in verse 37, he gets to the real issue, because they're not really asking a question about marriage, because their problem is the resurrection. You know, the Sadducees, I should have talked about this. The Sadducees are a group, a religious group, that only hold to the first five books of the Old Testament. They hold to the law. They are an aristocratic, wealthy, very conservative religious group. And they don't believe in such things as, you know, the Spirit and resurrection and all of these types of things. They believe in, you know, obeying the law and following the law and those types of things. They don't believe in angels. They don't believe in the afterlife, you know, those things. Well, so they just use marriage, and they use the practice of levirate marriage to sort of get to hide what their bigger issue is, and that's the resurrection. So in verse 37... Jesus talks about that, about this life after death. But that the dead are raised, even Moses showed. So he's going to their authority, because, you know, they recognize the books that Moses wrote, the first five books of the Old Testament. Even Moses showed in the passage about the burning bush, where he calls the Lord the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Now he is not the God of the dead, but of the living, for all live to him. Some of the scribes answered and said, "Teacher, you have spoken well," for they did not have courage to ask him any longer about anything. So God, and it's pretty self-explanatory here, God speaks to Moses in the burning bush, and he introduces himself as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who lived 500 years before Moses. And he says, "I am," present tense, "the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." And he's not the God of the dead, he's God of the living. And so he's saying, "I am," present tense, "the God of people who are still living. Isaac and Jacob. That's who I am." So Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were alive and conscious 500 years after their death. And this is a very authoritative, isn't he? Because he can come in and, you know, on issues of earth, you know, taxes and those types of things, without even blinking, he can speak as one who has authority. And then issues of the resurrection, issues of life after death, he can speak as one of authority. Where does that kind of authority come from? Remember, he was challenged in a previous passage. Who gives you the authority to clean out the temple? You know, and he tells this parable of the vine growers and who he is, and he's the beloved son. Well, where does he get this kind of authority? Look at verse 41. Then he said to them, "How is it that they say Christ is David's son? For David himself says in the book of Psalms, 'The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet.' Therefore, David calls him Lord." And how is he his son? This is kind of a cryptic, you know, it's like trying to figure out exactly what Jesus is saying here. And to boil it all down, David says in a psalm about Messiah, about the son of David who was going to come, Psalm 110, David says, "The Lord God said to my Lord, Messiah, sit at my right hand, I'll make the enemies under your feet. On in Psalm 110, talking about what would happen with Messiah and what God would do. But Messiah is also David's son, and this is a patriarchal society where the father is always greater than the son, but not in this case. So David is saying, my Lord, this one who's going to be my descendant, pre-exists me. That Messiah, a human descendant of David, he's divine. And so Jesus, where does your authority come from? My authority comes because I'm that guy, he's saying. That's me. David says, my Lord said to my Lord. He's talking about me. That's where my authority comes from. So I can speak into the issues of earth and taxes and the relationship between, you know, God's people and the state. Authority as one who's been there from heaven. You know, issues of the resurrection and life after death. And I can speak of authority and all types of things. Because when David said, said to my Lord, that was me. That's who he's talking about. So we have seen this one ride in to Jerusalem as a king. We've seen him go to the temple and his authority was challenged. We have now seen him assert that authority in issues of earth, issues of heaven. And now we're wondering, is he going to, like the prince and Cinderella, is he going to polarize good and evil and evil in its place? Will he exalt righteousness and humility and those types of things? What's he going to do now with the scribes, the Pharisees, all those who are questioning him? Let's read on. Verse 45. And while all the people were listening, he said to the disciples, beware of the scribes, who like to walk around in long robes and love respectful greetings in the marketplaces and chief seats in the synagogues and places of honor at banquets, who devour widows' houses and for appearance sake offer long prayers. These will receive greater condemnation. Luke gives us three verses. Matthew gives us an entire chapter, Matthew 23. If you want a much fuller account of what Jesus says against the Pharisees and the scribes, you can look in Matthew 23. Very familiar words, woe to you, Pharisees and scribes, for you clean the outside of the cup, and the inside is full of self-indulgence. Woe to you, Pharisees and scribes, for you're like whitewashed sepulchers. You're pretty on the outside, on the inside you're full of dead man's bones. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, for you tithe your dill and your mint, but you reject the bigger issues of justice and mercy. Your house, he says in verse 23, in Matthew 23, your house is left to you desolate. And he pronounces judgment upon them. And then he says, how I long to gather you like a hen gathers its chicks, and you would have nothing of it. Throughout the Bible, or not throughout, but several places in Scripture, there are pictures of what are called zoomorphisms, where God is pictured with sort of animal-type qualities. And one of the most frequently used one is the wing of God, the protective wing of God. You know, we see that in Ruth, where Ruth, you know, pleads for the hides under the protective wing of Israel's God. And Jesus says, I wanted to get under my wing. That was my wing. When people talk about hiding under the wing of God, that's my wing, and I want to gather you under my wing, and you would have nothing of it. And Matthew 23 ends with Jesus saying, you will not see me again until you say, in a truer context, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Just said, which the people just said, but rejected, he's going to come back again and they're going to say it again. He says, you're not going to see me. And in the meantime, your house is going to be desolate and destruction's going to come. What kind of authority does this man have? He can come in and speak of things of earth and taxes and, you know, relationship between the righteous and the state and those types of things. He can speak of issues of heaven and the resurrection. He can then to the religious leaders, and he can point out their evil, expose who they are, pronounce destruction upon them. That is the type of man that we're talking about.
That kind of authority. He has now put the stepsisters in their place,
and now he turns his head. And now he exalts Cinderella. Let's keep reading in chapter 21.
We just saw him pronounce that the scribes devour widows' houses. They are oppressing people. Let's look at one of these women who are being oppressed. And he looked up and saw the rich putting their gifts into the treasury, and he saw a poor widow putting in two small copper coins, and he said, "Truly I say to you, this poor widow put in more than all of them. For they out of their surplus put into the offering, but she out of her poverty put in all that she had to live on." At this time,
it was believed that wealth was a sign of righteousness. That God, out of his approval of who you are and of your life, demonstrated that approval through giving of financial blessings. And so the richer you were, the more righteous you were. And so in the temple, you would have different places where you would drop your offerings. You'd have these sort of bronze, you know, these sort of bronze bowls, and you would have, and each one is for a different type of coin, and so you'd exchange your money to these different types of coins, and you'd sort of do the circuit, and you'd drop these coins into these brass, you know, things, like clang, 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 and you go to the next one, clang, 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 clang. Sometimes you'd have someone go before you and say, "Here is, you know, Scott the Generous, you know," or whatever, and it's clang, clang, clang. Everyone's like, "Ooh and ah, look how righteous they are. How wealthy they are. How generous they are." Jesus looks at that and says, "Oh, brother." He doesn't actually say that he said that, but I'm convinced that that's what he said. "Oh, brother." And he sees one that nobody else sees. One who sneaks kind of around, gives the smallest offering she can, two small copper coins, two pennies, essentially. It's all she has. She doesn't want anybody to see her because she's ashamed. She's ashamed of who she is. She's not doing this for show. She's not doing this because of the law. She's doing this because she loves God. And God sees that which is done in private. And God sees her. And so you have all of this, you know, you're wondering if, you know, if the bad guys are going to win. Is Cinderella going to be exalted? He puts the bad guys in their place. He turns her head. He turns his head and says, "That is the model of what it's supposed to look like." And nobody saw her, but because Jesus saw her, she has now for 2,000 years been placed as the model of what it looks like to love God. Jesus saw her. Who says that that's the model of what righteousness looks like? Jesus says, "Say, because I'm the king. And because I have the right and the authority to say so." He puts the scribes and the Pharisees in their place. And he sees one who is humble. This one, you know, in Deuteronomy, in the Shema of Israel, "You, Israel, the Lord your God is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind, all your strength." And you have this one who doesn't have very much, but what she does have, she gives it all. And Jesus says, "That's what it looks like." And he exalts Cinderella.
Why is this passage here?
It's here to show the authority and the grace and the power and the majesty and the divinity of this one man. who has the authority to say such things. Say such things in matters of earth, in matters of heaven, in matters of evil versus righteousness, and those types of things. It's also to demonstrate, if we kind of read these, you know, back to back like we just did, there are a lot of those who are, you know, vying for the attention of everybody else, living their religion for everybody else, and God has eyes. He sees through all of that, and he can see into someone's heart. And just as Jesus says, you know, and the God who sees what is done in private will reward you. You know, like, you know, don't let your right hand know what your left hand is doing. Do things in secret because God sees you. God sees her. It's one thing to sort of play by the rules, and I think that we can all just sort of honestly say that, you know, in 2008 and, you know, evangelical circles, there's a certain way that you're supposed to look, a certain way you're supposed to act, talk, you know, a certain way, you know, those types of things. Sort of play by the rules in front of everybody else. And that's one thing. It's another thing to love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind, all your strength. And God knows the difference. God knows the difference. And you can fool everybody else, but you can't fool him. And he knows if you're loving him with all your heart, with all your soul. And even if nobody else, God sees it, and that's enough. And that's enough. And this is one who has unique authority to enter into the scene of your life and to speak with power, authoritative statements in every area of your life. You don't just sort of tithe a certain aspect of your life to him. He speaks with authority in your relationships with the state, in your views, you know, your religious views of things of, you know, heaven and earth, and in the issues of your money and all those types of things. He can speak with authority because he uniquely has that authority. What a Savior. Let's pray, and then we will be done and sing another song.